close our, any further testimony on this? No. We'll close our hearing on Senate Bill 311, and we'll have some draft one amendments here, and we'll bring this back in a week or so. Let's open a, Mr. Manera, what would be next on your docket? Did you have, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 171, and Mr. Manera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Manera with the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 171 involves six different of our programs, and they're basically changes we'd like to propose to make them a little more efficient. So this is, for us, is sort of a streamlining bill on a number of different programs. The first, I have the summary, and then there's background material behind it. Section one of the bill deals with leased property and exempt organizations using that property. Let me start with real basics on exempt property. Again, it's a property tax bill. Really, in Oregon, the way that you've exempted property is under two basic categories. Under, if it's owned by the government, it's exempt, regardless of use. Otherwise, it's the use of the property that qualifies it for the exemption. And now you have, in this case, when you have leases of the property, you have two basic categories there that you've dealt with. One is that that's not involved in this bill, there's a parallel, is that if a taxable owner leases it to an exempt organization for an exempt use, what you've done is exempted the property, and then you have required the taxable owner to pass those savings through by lower lease payments to the exempt organization. So if normally be taxable, but you lease it to someone that's going to use it for exempt purposes, the exemption savings flow through in lower lease payments to the exempt organization.
An illustration would be if I were an owner of a storefront building in a downtown area, and I leased to a church who came in and occupied that space, I could then apply for an exemption on that space. I'd have to then give them a discounted rent, or that would have to be reflected in the rent I charge the church.
That's correct.
Okay.
And there's a test for, there's a test that's followed to check on that to be sure that the lease has been done. Now this, the instance in this bill is, and that test works fine. We aren't having any problems with that in the system. This provision deals with when an exempt organization leases to another exempt organization. So there wouldn't be a tax anyway. There's language in there on a rent test, and that rent test basically has been. You see on page one of the bill, there on lines, actually on line 17 of the first page, the rent charge does not exceed the cost of repairs, maintenance, amortization, and upkeep. So there is a test on the rent, even though it's from one exempt organization to another, and there are no tax savings. That test has been, the county assessors haven't really been able to figure out how to administer that test. It's been very, very difficult to do it. Basically, there would appear to be no real good reason to have a test between exempt organizations. So what we're proposing here in Section 1 is to eliminate the test because really there are no tax savings to pass through. And I'm not sure why the legislature put that test in there in the first place. I'm not familiar with that history. But we really haven't been operating under it in the system in terms of administration.
Does this do anything for a private individual, a piece of property that they then sort of donate for use as a ball field by the local little leagues or something along that line?
Well, this would be this Senator Dukes. This part of the provision would again has to be an exempt organization that owns it. that is letting it, either is leasing it to another exempt organization. It would be like the city. It could be like the city owns the building, and they lease it out to the church or another exempt organization for use.
But if I own a field and I say to the local Little League, you can use this, and that's all that it's used for, I'm still pay property taxes.
I think so.
Right.
Why don't you go ahead and write something, please?
Susan Payne, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair and Committee, there's the other lease statute where the taxable entity owns the property and allows the use or rent or lease to a qualified exempt organization. And that would be the case of the ball field, where the taxable entity owns the ball field property. Little League would apply for the exemption.
Is Little League
a nonprofit organization?
Are they? Oh, okay. I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
It sounds to me, in reading the entire section, that what it is saying, what the old language is, that if a tax-exempt organization owns a building, for an example, and does not pay tax on it, then for whatever reason chooses to rent it to another tax-exempt organization, they cannot charge more than what it costs to keep the building up and amortize the building out. In other words, they can't make a profit on it in order to be exempt from the tax. Mm-hmm. And are you, by this language, allowing then a tax-exempt organization that may at lease a building to another tax-exempt organization to make a profit on that rent, while they still realize to pay still being exempt from the property tax. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, the part that you're excluding, deleting here, says, and the rent charge does not exceed the cost of repairs, maintenance, amortization, and upkeep. That's very restrictive. In other words, you can't make a profit on it.
But in Nell's illustration, it doesn't quite come into the same way. But for instance, you have adoption agencies in the state of Oregon now that are placing children with adoptive families. And they request a donation of, let's say, $20,000 to place that child. Well, the cost of running the program is really only, let's say, $5,000, but the other $15,000 goes to support other programs, so they're getting a profit off of a service. And the same situation here is that they could be using the profit on this building to support other services, and that's a policy question that you're eliminating here with this bill.
Right, and if they do that, what you're doing with this bill is allowing them to further have a tax exemption on the property by deleting the language that you are.
To essentially charge a market rate.
Yes.
Or whatever.
And what the statute, you know, I have no background in this other than to read it, but it appears that what the statute's saying is, if you want to lease it, that's fine, but you can't lease it you can't make a profit off what you lease if you want to keep the tax exemption. It appears that you're removing that.
Well, that is the test. The problem with administering the test is that the assessor doesn't have the information to know whether that rent actually meets that test.
But isn't that the assessor's job, is to go find out?
Well, the assessor,
he gets in his car and drives over there and knocks on the door and
determine that. But if
we also have, I'm sorry for interrupting you, an obligation to the leasor to comply with this regulation, notwithstanding whether the assessor finds out if they are or not. They have an obligation, if they are applying for that exemption, to comply with these statutory provisions, to not make a profit off the building if they want to turn around and get the tax exemption. And they, now I'm assuming they know that. And if they know that and they do receive a profit, well, then we have a problem. They have a problem, whether the assessor finds out or not.
You could always require that exempt properties that are leased submit an annual report to the assessor's office.
Yeah. I think we need to think about this one a little more. Why don't you go on for the rest of the sections then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 2 deals with small rail car taxes. Now, what you have under the law is for your major railroads and even large rail car companies. Rail car company are the ones that basically own the rail cars and then either lease them out to the railroads or lease them out to companies to use them. What happened historically was when you get to the really small rail car companies, and by statute that's a value under $300,000, $300,000 could be two brand new cars, or it could be a number of old depreciated cars. These are really small companies. What we did before you created this category was taking those really small values, and when we'd spread them out to the counties, you'd have a number of counties making really small billings to these companies. So what you did is said, in the case of these companies, and there are about 150 of them, 120 of them, instead of having the counties do all that work, why doesn't the department do the calculation itself? We do the values on them. Once you do the calculation yourself and bill the companies directly, that way the company gets one bill instead of from all the counties because it's a small amount. Now we do that. Now this deals with the distribution of the tax. So we collect the tax, and now we distribute it back to the counties, the tax itself. That distribution, we have the values for the department, and that distribution now under statute requires that we distribute it back based on the taxes that have been imposed on the other rail car companies. And that requires a step of going to the county. They have to send us all of the taxes imposed, and then we do a percentage. What this bill would do is would skip that step, and basically we would distribute the taxes back on values that we already have rather than taking the step with the taxes. Now we've attached to the summary on page one under small rail car tax distribution. We went back and ran it both ways for 2 years, 95-96 and 94-95, and there was a negligible difference in doing it one way as to the other. And keep in mind, this piece of the tax is really minute in terms of what the county is getting in, because the county's already getting in taxes from all of the major railroads and the large car companies and other centrally assessed property, and so these taxes are very small. So to the extent that there is some little deviation, it's not really any kind of an impact in terms of the general system. But this would eliminate the work for the county and the department trying to do this by gathering the tax is imposed to distribute it rather than just using the values we already have.
Hmm. Questions?
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Were you trying to? What's the impact of exempting essentially $300,000?
Oh, Senator Leonard, this is not an exemption. All it's doing is saying the taxes are paid on these. All this piece of the law with $300,000 of value and lower takes these really small companies, and the department bills them directly instead of having all the counties bill them through the normal property tax process. So all it does is consolidate that for the company, so they get one bill from the state. It's the same amount of money, no exemption. They pay their full taxes, and then we distribute the tax back to the county instead of the county trying to collect it. It's really initially an efficiency measure, it's easier on the company.
It doesn't have any effect on the county's income from that tax?
No.
And the county doesn't have the administration cost of trying to run the program?
That's right.
Yep.
The county receives the same tax, it's just that we bill it and send it to them instead of them having to bill it through their normal property tax process.
Yep.
And this just, in determining how much to send back to each county, this just eliminates a step and gets you almost the same result, very close.
Good. Further questions on Section 2? Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Then the next sections deal with local budget law, but in particular, The actual copying and storing of budgets is really what this deals with. In the process, when all of the districts do their budgeting process, the law now requires them, and we have about 1,600 in the state, the law requires them to, school districts and all, to give copies of their budgets, and they send one copy to the county clerk, and they send two copies to the county assessor, and the assessor passes on one of those copies to the Department of Revenue. Now, that's the full, complete, detailed budget. In addition to that, they already file really summaries of the information, and that's really the information that's used by most everybody. And the only time we ever get into the big detailed budget is when a particular issue comes up that you really need to go back and look at the full budget. What the bill is trying to do is eliminate some of those copies out of the system, or requiring the districts to have the large budgets and to store them somewhere when they're really not used that much. Bill Aldrich with our program will give you a little more detail on that.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Aldrich. I'm with the Department of Revenue. In this process of reviewing budgets, we primarily are in the assessor's office, are primarily involved in trying to determine if the taxing district has the authority to levy the tax that they're going to put on the tax roll, and if it's properly categorized. The kinds of documents that we want to continue to keep getting and have the assessor to continue to keep getting are those kinds of documents that show that the district's levy authority is within its limitations and properly categorized. The budget document itself, the detailed budget document that looks at the expenditures and revenues, what they want to spend their money on, is really a fiscal policy document. It's one that really is of concern to the governing body, to the citizens of that district and its budget committee. And the decisions that are made in those budget documents are ones that the Department of Revenue and the assessor are really not involved in. Those are decisions that they need to make. We looked at the budget documents that we were getting and the size of them and the cost of storing them and keeping them and how often we used them. And in fact, the last couple of years, I don't think we looked at any of the detailed budget documents at all.
If you want them, all you have to do is just call up the county or special district and send me a copy.
Correct. And that's included in the bill and what we've taken out, that if we or the assessor or the Division of Audits would need a copy of the detailed budget document, they would be available. But this would eliminate the requirement that they would have to send two copies.
So right now you take 1,600 different documents and categorize and file them, index them, make sure they're all there, hassle somebody if they didn't send you the document, and you've probably got some FTE time just doing that processing.
Correct.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Senator?
I'm just still here. I do have one. I'm asking for the statute. I can't get the answer. On page 3, line 38, you're deleting that the district would have to submit two copies of this summary mail to the electors under ORS 294-421. Is that the ballot title?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes. Really what that is part, once the budget committee has approved the budget, there's a summary of that budget doc, the budget as approved by the budget committee, that's either published, posted, or mailed, depending on the condition. There's three different requirements depending on the size of the budget and whether or not a newspaper is published in that municipal corporation. As part of the budget document that we've gotten a detailed budget document and a copy of that summary. And basically we use that summary to look at the size of the budget or the tax levy that was approved by the budget committee. And we've included in 2A here that we would, or in 2B, that we would get a statement that the budget committee actually approved the tax levy. So we felt if we had that, there was no longer a need for us to get a copy of the summary that was published or mailed or posted. And certainly for those people who, or those taxing districts who do publish that, it becomes sometimes difficult for them to get a copy of it. It's a hassle for them, and it's not something that we use other than to ensure that the tax levy was included in that publication. And if we get a statement that the tax levy was approved by the Budget Committee, we feel we've got what we need.
Well, it's published usually in the local newspaper, isn't it?
Correct.
I can't imagine it's a hassle to get a copy of it. But what I'm wondering is, that's one of the requirements in order to be able to collect the taxes. There are certain hoops you have to jump through to get the taxes, and publication is one of those. And if you, I guess I always assumed that by them having to send some of this stuff to the assessors, to you, to whomever, that somebody made sure all the hoops were jumped through. Are you telling me that nobody's checking to see that all those things are done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, there's a lot of requirements in local budget law, and a lot of things that could be checked and reviewed at the state level. And basically what we're trying to say is that those portions that revolve around fiscal policy are things that we shouldn't review anyway, and we don't have the staff to do an in-depth review of 1,600 budgets. So what we try to do is to focus the resources that we have to ensure that the levy is correct and that that the district has the authority to make the levy, the responsibility to follow the process, we believe, is a responsibility of the local government, its budget committee, and its citizens. And to the extent that we have staff, we provide assistance to those governments to comply with the statutes. If problems occur, we work with citizens who think that the process is not being followed and work with that local government to try to make sure that they understand what their requirements are and do our best to ensure that they do. But we do not look at 1,600 budgets. We do not look at 1,600 publications to ensure that all of the processes in local budget law that district is required to follow has been followed. We don't get all of the meeting minutes, even under current law, under the current filings. There are additional steps in local budget law, minutes from meetings and things that we could have been required to be submitted to Department of Revenue and that could be checked. We don't do that.
I know this if you looked at the budget, so we did a lot of the rest of that. In the day and age that we're at today, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, I would feel more comfortable if somebody actually looked at the process. I can tell you that I have one district that doesn't follow the ballot title when they go to spend their money. And there are, the incentive to do that is increasing under the fiscal restraints mm-hmm. that they're under today. And I'm not suggesting that it should be the Department of Revenue, but I guess we put those in there in case somebody decides that a district isn't, so they have some of recourse.
Doesn't the county clerk have some sort of oversight or review, make sure that there's at least the legal ability to levy the amount and it's properly spent?
Nope, they just accept the filings and put it on the ballot.
Or depend upon the electors then to essentially review and...
We have a board of tax supervisors in Baltimore County. I don't know if that's in every county, but they do review everything that goes on the ballot.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, as far as your department is concerned, you don't have the ability now, and you haven't for the last 2 years, review these documents.
That's correct, sir.
And if you need them, you can simply call them up, and they're probably available locally anyway. You get a copy.
That's correct.
And Senator Dukes has a good point. I don't know how we address it.
I don't either.
Yeah. Further questions on sections 4 through 6? Mr. Maneri, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sections 7 through 11 deal with basically trying to put the department in a position to allow our electronic age to work if it can in terms of filings. Currently, and this deals with both filing of petitions of appeal with boards and also with filings of applications for exemption. Currently, the first thing that came up in a few years back was, can somebody file using a fax? Everybody had been used to mail and originals, and now would a fax work? And the Attorney General reviewed that and said, yes, we think that's okay under the statute. The statute requires that it be in writing and it be signed, and some other requirements in terms of petitions and information. We're looking down the road in terms of other electronic media that may be available, and if there's anything that would allow for the streamlining of that, make it easier for citizens to file with their board or file applications and for the board to accept them, we'd like to be able to spell that out by administrative rule so it was clear what had to be done. Even now, with probably the big question now with electronic, and we know it's true for income tax returns, is verifying with a signature,
mm-hmm.
How you do that. And I know initially the IRS has dealt with electronic filings, and then you had to mail in a card with your signature, so you still had a paper process. But I assume one of these days there'll be an electronic process that also allows you to electronically communicate the signature along with it, and that would count the same as your written. So all this is doing is just allowing us, as these issues come up, to try to work with the boards and the counties to find ways to allow this to happen.
There won't be any conflict with this in Measure 47, which I'm always assumed is going to rewrite the Board of Equalization laws. Just it allows you administrative rulability.
Okay. Right, Senator Dukes, this is just the process of filing. Yes, Measure 47, we do have in House Bill 2048, a provision for trying to streamline the board process, going back to one board. But that'll come over from the House. So there is that in there.
We'll be sick of it before we're over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Questions on Sections 7 through 11? Could continue.
Sections 12 through 22 have to deal with back to the senior citizens program, and this is the special assessment program with like the sewer districts that Shirley Leeper was talking about. Shirley, you want to come back up?
So this is not the property tax deferral.
That's correct.
Special assessment.
Just the special assessment program. And we're trying to do a few things here. One is to bring in line the filing requirements to be the same, just to go to annual instead of every year. It's every year under the special assessment now. Also to deal with making payments to make it more efficient on the program. And I'll let Shirley go ahead and walk through that.
Okay. For the record,
what's the difference between annual and every year?
I'm sorry, Senator Dukes. A one-time filing.
Okay.
I misstated myself.
Yeah.
One-time filing on the regular property tax.
And figured everybody else up here knew the difference, and I didn't.
I'm glad you got that, and an annual one for the special assessment.
Okay. For the record, my name is Shirley Leeper with the Department of Revenue, and what we're trying to do is streamline the program a little bit, make it so that the taxpayers do not have to be required to file annually, and that the taxing district does not have to do that extra paperwork each year. And by going to an annual filing, they would file the same as in the property tax deferral program one time, and then that application would go for the life of that deferral on the special assessment. Presently, the way payments are made to the taxing districts, every taxing district, as they sell their bonds, there's different payment periods. You may have one, say, in February and in July or August. So we're making payments to the taxing districts every other week for the payments that are due during that two-week period. And what we would like to do is make those twice a year. So we have everybody that's in that six-month increment. Their payment goes out on the 1st of January to the taxing district. And then the second half of the year, it goes out the 1st of July to those taxing districts. It would eliminate some of the paperwork in generating checks and posting checks and payments at the opposite end. Another part of the bill is we have a lot of accounts that are quite small. Some of them we have payments as small as $3 every 6 months. Hmm. We would like to take any account that has an outstanding balance of $1,000 and under and pay that account in full. Presently, the taxing district is holding those accounts. We get a billing from them once a year with interest on that. and their interest rate is usually higher than ours, so we have to make the payment plus the interest.